Troy Clark is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Clark to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan. The Execution Watch for Troy Clark begins.
Good evening and welcome to the Wednesday, September 23rd, 2018 edition of Execution Watch. Whether you are listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue, filling in for Ray Hill. And as many of you know, Ray is currently in hospice. However, he will be joining us by phone a little later in this broadcast, so please stay tuned for that. Now, if you are tuning in for Arab Voices with Saeed, usually heard here every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. You can also join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Troy Clark, sentenced to death for the 1998 drowning death of the 20-year-old female former roommate. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. This program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally on the World Wide Web. And we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Huhan, joins us now live by phone from outside of the death house in Huntsville. As we try and get Linda on the phone, let's just talk a little bit more with our panel. Now, Larry Douglas, tell us a little bit about this case.
Well, Marlo, it appears that Troy Clark is going to be executed this evening for the murder of Christina Muse. The reason it's a death penalty case is apparently that the murder occurred during the course of a kidnapping. Back in 1998, Troy Clark was apparently a meth dealer in Tyler, Smith County, Texas. And he lived with a girlfriend of his, Tori Bush. Tori was the primary witness against Troy Clark. They lived together, and for a short period of time, Christina Muse lived with them, and apparently witnessed the drug use and drug sales activity that went on inside the house.
All right, we're going to get more into details about this and why we are at the stage we are today a little bit later, but let's join Linda Huhan right now. She's at the death house in Huntsville. Linda, I'm glad you're there. Thank you for this. Tell us, please, describe the scene for us there in Huntsville, Texas.
Well, it's raining very hard. We're very soaking wet, but we're out here. And the media just crossed, and now the family is crossing. So it's taking place, apparently.
So who is standing witness that you know of?
Who's out here with us, or?
And now did they just cross into the death house?
They just got into the door, yes.
Tell me, Linda, how many people are there outside of the death house at this point in time?
There's like 13.
Are they protesting? Are they for this execution to proceed? Are they...
No, we're all protesters on this side. They don't allow the other ones that are not protesting against to be with us.
Have you spoken to any of the relatives of Troy Clark or any of the relatives of the deceased?
No. We have one girl here that is Troy's best friend, and she was with him all for the last 2 days, and she's here today, and she talked to him on the last phone call today.
So he has had contact with the outside world since then?
Yes, he has.
And you will be there reporting for us. What are the people there saying? What is the mood outside of the death house right now?
Very sad. There's a lot of tears right now because Troy had friends. And he was tired. I guess that's what I should say. He just was tired of living the way he was living, so he gave up his appeal.
We've heard, of course, that he has refused final interviews with some of the outlets, media outlets, etc. So you think that this tiredness was just a part of it, or just giving up?
I don't know that he gave up. I think he was just tired.
All right. Linda, we're going to be coming back to you a little bit later on. If you don't mind, contact us as soon as you get word.
Okay, I sure will.
Thank you.
When they come out of the death house?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, absolutely. Call Bob back here at the station.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. That was our reporter, Linda Hujan. She was joining us live from outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas. Now, this is sort of an online winged thing. It's always tragic when life is questioned and lost. But there's always different sides of the story. And what we're going to do right now is talk a little bit more with Larry and figure out how we got to this point. Larry Douglas.
Well, Marlo, as I mentioned, Troy and his girlfriend, Tori Bush, allowed Christina Muse to live with them for a short period of time, mm-hmm. for a period of time. And then she moved out. But she'd witnessed everything that went on inside the house.
So she knew about this meth dealing, and, I mean, there was no question about that.
She testified that she knew.
Mm-hmm.
Tori testified that she knew.
The girlfriend.
But Troy was concerned that perhaps... Christina Muse might start talking to what he considered the wrong people and might snitch him out. And he expressed this according to her testimony to Tori. And Tori, the girlfriend, who was actually one of the co-defendants, she was also charged with the same death. And she pled out
to her.
She pled out to a 20-year sentence, and she should be getting out on parole pretty soon. But she was the primary person testifying against him, that Tori was. And in fact, I think some of Troy's, writings from prison, suggest that, his claim was that Tori actually committed the crime, not him. But in any event, she is the one who testified against him. And according to her testimony, when Troy got concerned that Christina Muse might snitch him out, that she actually witnessed what was there in the house when Christina came by, at Troy's request, and they had a meeting right there in the house.
Mm.
Now, Tori says, I wasn't right there with them, but I've heard them in there talking. And then at some point, according to Tori's testimony, Roy stunned Muse with a stun gun to her neck. Okay? So that would make that, and after he stuns her with a stun gun to her neck, he then bound her hands and legs and mouth with duct tape and stuffed her in a closet for several hours. That makes the kidnapping. Okay, and then after the kidnapping, he takes her out of the bedroom, and he calls Tori and says, bring me a board. So Tori says, according to her testimony, she brings him a board. And then she walks out of the room and she hears a loud whack. And she suspects that the whack was Troy actually hitting Muse with the board. Then she says that Troy calls her into the bathroom because he takes Christina Muse out of the bedroom closet, takes her to the bathroom, and puts her in the bathtub, and calls Tori and tells Tori that she needs to help Troy drown Christina. According to Tori's testimony, she says she resisted, and Troy threatened her. So then she confesses to actively participating in the murder. So after the murder was completed, after the killing was completed, according to Tori's testimony, she was told by Troy Clark to go and buy some lime. She goes into to a neighbor, goes to the store to get some lime. She comes back. She says that Troy has Muse's body in a 55-gallon blue barrel, along with some cement material and other trash, and he dumps the lime on that and other trash and puts water in it and then seals the drum. Now, this is, again, all according to Tori Bush's testimony. Then she says that Troy Clark has some other gentlemen take the sealed barrel, help him take the sealed barrel out to his truck. He then takes the body with the inside the barrel to his landlord's property. She says he then borrows a tractor owned by the landlord and takes the trash and other things out. She doesn't know where he took it. So for months, Tristina's body's not recovered.
Right.
Okay, and actually, in the course of looking for Christina Muse's body, they thought they found the body, but as it turned out, there was the body of a male inside a barrel, a male by the name of Tracy Mize. Tracy Mize was scheduled to testify against Troy Clark regarding Troy Clark's extensive meth operation. And then he ends up dead.
Well, of course, now does Troy have any kind of repercussions about or charged for anything to do with Tracy Mize and the death? Was that also brought in?
It was brought in that Tracy Mize's body was discovered in the as part of the punishment evidence in the trial, okay? And while Troy Clark was not separately charged with that offense, it is believed, with prosecutorial discretion being what it is, they don't have to charge him with that. They can use any prior bad acts at punishment.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't want to get into a lot of that because they wanted to if the capital murder didn't go through. Okay, if they didn't get death on him, then they could also charge him with the Tracy Mize murder.
So they had a backup.
I guess you could put it that way.
Yeah.
So anyway.
I mean, meth dealers are not known to be warm and fuzzy people. And it sounds like you've got a bunch of bad actors here.
Troy Clark, at least according to Tori Bush, his girlfriend, who he lived with, her testimony. But again, she was testifying to get a lighter sentence,
mm-hmm.
and the jury knew all that. Okay, but those are the pertinent facts of the killing.
Okay.
So then he goes to trial. He's got counsel at trial, and this is a capital murder. So a capital murder trial, just like any other trial, is broken up into two parts. You've got guilt, innocence, and then you've got punishment. In a capital, though, if the person is found guilty, there are only two possible outcomes. That is, life in the penitentiary or death. And so the primary concern is in defending it. If there is a guilty finding, then the decision as to whether to put the guy, the defendant to death is based on the balancing of two separate issues. That is, future dangerousness. Is the person a future danger to society? And mitigation. Are there some reasons why the person should not be put to death? So, this case raises several different issues. The primary issues, being, well, in a capital murder, in any case, but particularly capital murder case, you do have an automatic appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you get the state appeal, and then you've got what we call collateral kinds of remedies, and that is habeas corpus procedures, first in state court, then in federal court. But as to how the punishment phase was handled in the trial court phase. I think Paige is going to talk about the way the punishment phase was handled after he was found guilty in terms of what kind of mitigation evidence was provided, if any. But in this case, it's particularly interesting. The punishment phase was particularly interesting when you consider that, Troy Clark testified himself.
Right.
At the punishment phase.
And what venue was this?
This was in Tyler. This is in Smith County, Texas.
Okay, so up in North Texas.
Right.
Northeast
right,
Texas.
Right.
Let's
so,
is
Jack, did you want to go ahead?
Let's go to Jack Lee.
I can talk about the ineffective assistance of counsel. So what, on appeal, one of Clark's contentions was that at trial, his trial attorney failed to, rendered ineffective assistance of counsel because, among other things, that he didn't bring up any mitigation evidence. Well, first of all, and then afterwards, he also said that on direct appeal, there was also ineffective assistance of counsel because at direct appeal, the appellate attorney did not bring up that, you know, there was ineffective assistance of counsel on the trial. So, you know, he's got ineffective assistance of counsel everywhere. But the problem with and we see this on really most cases, this argument of ineffective assistance of counsel, because I call this the kitchen sink argument, because when you don't have much traction on anything else, you blame the attorneys. And keep in mind that these attorneys who handle these death penalty cases really are the best of all of us. They are really the top notch. You can't buy them for the tiny bag of gold that they get for handling these cases. The Strickland test applies to all of the ineffective assistance of counsel's issues that are ever brought up. First of all, you have to have an objective standard that these attorneys failed at what they were doing because they were substantially below, they were objectively below the standard of being a proper, competent attorney. And that's a real, real hard mountain to climb. You know, among other things, your attorney can be drunk and that would still not be ineffective assistance of counsel. Your attorney could be asleep and that would still not be an effective assistance
of
counsel.
And it has been held that it's not ineffective assistance of counsel when the lawyer fell asleep in a
That is correct.
And that's Paige Yannick, everyone.
Yeah.
And Go on, Jack.
Okay. And then on top of that, as if that weren't a big enough mountain to climb, the other mountain to climb is if the attorney had been competent, that it would have completely changed the course of, it would have changed the result. Well, I'm not really sure if that could have possibly happened in this case. Because Clark, when his attorney wanted to bring up mitigation evidence, Clark said, no, don't bring up any mitigation evidence. I don't want you to. In fact, I don't want you to bring up, Clark's attorney had prepped his mother, his father, and a small gaggle of other folks to help out on mitigation evidence. And Clark said, no, I don't want any of those people. I don't want any of those people talking about this case. And so it didn't happen. So what his attorney did do was bring up an expert that said, well, you know, the future dangerousness is, he's not going to be future danger given what he's seen. His fallback position was, well, looking at actuarial tables, I don't think he's going to be a future danger. Well, that's like saying, okay, well, I'm looking at actuarial tables. I'm probably not going to get into a car accident today, so I don't really need insurance or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't make Clark's attorney did the very best with the really awful hand tying that he was instructed to do by his client. It was just, I mean, there was not much he could have done.
Paige, do they have accurate actuarial tables for meth dealers?
No, New York Life does not prepare those actuarial tables. I'm so sorry.
If I could chime in just for a minute,
please,
Marlo,
do.
In terms of the punishment phase.
Please.
Clark's lawyer didn't provide any evidence on mitigation. Now, despite what your client wants you to do, okay, the argument can be made that some mitigation evidence could have been offered, but there was nothing offered at that trial on mitigation. Now, in the habeas efforts, there was much mitigation offered, but at trial, the trial lawyer didn't present any mitigating evidence. Now, he prepared Clark's mother and father and other potential witnesses for mitigation, but didn't present any of them, didn't present any documentation, did not engage a mitigation expert to develop mitigation. But he did raise the argument through the expert regarding future danger. But that's a kind of tricky argument to make, in that after it is believed that after Clark was murdered, Muse, they actually murdered another person. Okay, which means that at least at the time of the...
Wait, let me get this right.
We have murder one, Davis. We have murder two.
No, then Muse.
Muse.
Okay.
Yeah. Muse is murder two.
Muse is murder one. Mize is murder two.
That's correct.
That's what they believe. Okay, but
who's Davis?
But at the punishment phase, not only was there, well, where the issue in a capital murder at punishment is life or death, and you can only influence that by providing evidence on future danger and on mitigation. There was nothing offered on mitigation. Now, in the collateral efforts and in the habeas actions, the question is raised. Would it have made any difference? And if you bring that up, it's all subject to cross examination, and you might end up being worse than before. But nothing was presented on mitigation at the trial level. And Clark testified,
yes,
over the objection of his lawyer, and made things a lot worse.
So, bad lawyer. Why is this? Why are we here? And what happened in the sentencing, Paige? Why? I mean, Texas is the most watched state ever for executions. People watch us. Why should people be paying attention to this case?
Well, they can pay attention to this case because the issue at punishment becomes, how did the lawyer handle the punishment when he is almost literally handcuffed by his own client's refusal to let him discuss things about mitigation, and then the client's insistence that he take the stand as to future dangerousness. when the client decided to take the stand and testify about future dangerousness, then the issue about the other outstanding murders out there slowly seep into the trial and seep into in front of the jury, and the jury is hearing about the death of Mize and then the death of Muse, and then there may be a death of a third person out there, and all of that tends to make a juror think that this man is a danger to others. And probably 10 people on that jury had no problem determining that he was a danger in the future.
It gets worse than that, though, Marlo. Okay, not only is he testified, but he spars with the jury, will not take responsibility, he says, for something I didn't do, and then he tells the jury, I want the death penalty. I'd rather have the death penalty than to spend the rest of my life in prison for something I didn't do. So he's defiant
he's defiant and obdurate. And then, I mean, the jury rewards him with his desire, as it were.
You know, imagine if you're an attorney, if you're his attorney. You tell him, hey, I'm going to put on mitigation evidence, and he says no. And then you tell him, well, at least don't take the stand. And he starts arguing with you in front of a jury. You go up to the judge, and you start talking to the judge about this, and he's arguing with you in front of the jury. He's arguing with you every step of the way. If you're an attorney and you say, you know what, I know you think this is a good idea, but I know better. I have a duty to protect you, and I'm going to do what I think best. Great. You start putting on mitigation evidence, and he's going to start arguing with you. He's going to start arguing with, you know, this attorney was trying to, for lack of better words, minimize the blast zone. You know, because Clark was just gonna go off.
Right.
He went off in front of the judge and the jury. He went off, you know, in the punishment phase. Frankly, I feel badly for this attorney. I think he probably did the best he could.
Go ahead.
I agree that the lawyer did the best with a bad situation. I mean, we discussed this in preparation about what are the things that the lawyer could have done to minimize the blast area, as it were.
Put him on a methadone drip.
Okay, I know what I would have done.
Mike Gillespie, tell us.
Mike Gillespie. If my client told me not to interview anybody, if my client told me not to present any evidence, I can't. I would still go gather all the evidence. I can't present it because he doesn't want it. But you know what? The jury sees a crazed, dangerous drug dealer. And as Ray often says, the man we kill is not the man who committed the crime. You got a boy with a meth problem. Everybody here has got meth problems. These are meth addicts. These are paranoid people who are paranoid doing meth acting. I have read his pages like Larry has. I've read his poems. This guy, I'm not saying anything good, but his poems show insight to the terror and the pain he's going through for the crimes he committed. This man we're killing is not the animal who committed these crimes.
So there's good Troy and there's bad Troy, but...
Let me get to the point. If I was a lawyer and he wanted to testify, I'd let him testify. And when he's on the stand, I would say, isn't it true you didn't have a father? Isn't it true your mother was a hooker? Isn't it true your mother was a drug addict? Isn't it true your mother spent her whole life in the penitentiary? Isn't it true you were raised by different family members? Isn't it true you were beaten in your whole life? Isn't it true when you got older you got a fight with your brother and the next day your brother killed himself? Could this have led to your drug addiction? That's how you mitigate it. You don't need his permission. You ask him. You get the, if we normally use witnesses because we can't use the person. But he didn't want us to call the people, but you could have brought that evidence in with his own testimony. And now you're painting him to the jury like the witnesses would.
All right. The time is now 6:30. You are listening to Execution Watch here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.7 in Huntsville. Thank you for joining us today. Of course, live on the web. We are waiting to hear from our reporter at the Death House in Huntsville, Miss Linda Hujan. But meanwhile, we're here talking with Larry Douglas, with Paige Yannick, with Jack Lee and Mike Gillespie, and it's a pretty interesting conversation. Your regular host Ray Hill is not here tonight. I'm sorry for that. We will be also joining tomorrow at 6 p.m. for an additional execution that's going to be coming out. That is scheduled right now for Daniel Akers. So join us then. If you were listening for Arab Voices with Saeed, please join us again next Wednesday. He will be back and the show will be as usual. But meanwhile, thank you for joining us. This is Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. So this just sounds troubling, and what you say, Mike, makes perfect sense. But this is still someone who is presented as a bad actor when he's not locked up, when he's not inside the thing.
We don't know what he's like without drugs. And at what point of time are we going to blame, I'm not saying blame society, but these are people with serious drug addictions. That
right.
These are what happens when you have drug addictions. And I'm not saying anything except that if you, at that time he's executed, but he's not the same man he was before. The purpose of the penitentiary is the old adage of penance. When you get locked up and you don't do drugs, you sit and you think about what you did, that's the time you have mercy. There's an argument that Ray often says is that we should judge whether he should be executed after he's been in the penitentiary for a period of time, after he has no drugs and alcohol in his system.
And since he's been there for a couple of decades, hasn't that been enough time?
He's a different person, so make the decision now. No, make the decision back then. Put him in there for life. Make the decision after a period of time of whether we're going to do this. But let that man today, who the poems that I read and Larry read, let him come and talk to the people. Let the people see who they're killing. They're not seeing who they're killing. They're seeing a crazed meth person who is dangerous, who's killing people, beating them, and that's not who he is. That's who he was. Should he be punished for it? Absolutely. But should we kill him for it? We're just as bad as they are, as he is, if we do that.
And what part of analysis will you give us on this trip?
Well, the part that I'm interested in is kind of this. I think the death penalty is very dramatic. I think the death penalty, the only purpose of the death penalty is the detriment for crime. When Johnny commits a robbery and Johnny gets killed by the storekeeper, there's a chilling effect in the community. Johnny screwed up. When Johnny gets arrested and Johnny goes to court and Johnny gets executed 16 years later, the system killed him. The bad lawyers killed him. There's no chilling effect in the community because they're not there anymore. The problem with these cases, if we're going to have a death penalty, it should be a clear-cut reason for a death penalty. What I don't like are cases like this when we really don't know who committed it. There were two drug addicts there, him and her. Who did it? Of course we think he did it, but we don't know. We should not have a death penalty as part of a plea bargain where two people are arrested, they're both facing death penalty, who wants to testify first? You get 20 years, the other gets killed. That's not the purpose of execution.
So you're saying that our system is so set up for let's make a deal that we can't get a true verdict?
I'm saying we have a system like that and we probably need it, but not when it comes to executions. It's too severe. Too severe. We should not do this unless we're absolutely certain we have the right person. And I think we got the same scenario last night. Nobody knows what really happened. And again, you see all the time where there was today in the paper, a man is now facing a death penalty because he refused to plea. If you're going to offer him a plea bargain, if he refuses, why does he look at the death penalty? Mm-hmm. if the state thought he could get paroled out and be safe, well, why? Because you refused it. You make me go to trial. Now we're going to execute you.
Larry.
Well, sort of to add to Mike's point and also to Jack's point, Troy Clark is about 50 years old now, which means he was about 30 when these crimes were purportedly committed. One thing about lawyers, the more opportunities we have to develop something, the better we get at it. And if you look at the history of this case in terms of mitigation, as Mike was mentioning, there was mitigation evidence available but not presented at trial. So at trial, there was nothing presented at mitigation. Then at the and typically the ineffective assistance of counsel arguments are not normally made in direct appeal, but as Jack pointed out, normally it takes time to develop those, and those would be developed at the habeas corpus proceedings. At the first habeas proceeding, then the state habeas lawyer did 5 hours of mitigation work and provided a 2-page affidavit from Troy Clark's mother. And that 2-page affidavit provided the kinds of evidence that Mike would have asked at trial. That is, the evidence of Cleta Barrington, that's Clark's mother, talked about he had a terrible upbringing. The affidavit says he was born with a cleft palate that led to speech difficulties and ridicule by his peers, that she used drugs most of her adult life to support her habit through prostitution, resulting in her incarceration for much of his life, that his father had very little to do with him, that he was cycled between many family members during his formative years, including with her brother-in-law. He was subject to physical abuse, that Clark himself married at the age of 15 to avoid being placed in foster care. Clark's brother committed suicide, as Mike mentioned, when Clark was 20, and Clark blamed himself for that. And Clark's mother, even in her affidavit, said that had she been contacted by trial counsel, that she had not been, according to her, had not been contacted by trial counsel, but if given an opportunity, that she would have cooperated. But he spent a total of 5 hours preparing the state habeas. By the federal habeas, there was an extensive mitigation expert was retained. Now, we Monday morning quarterback everything anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and then lawyers don't mind falling on the sword. These lawyers fell on the sword for him saying, we didn't do a good job. But by federal, habeas time, they had engaged a mitigation expert, who provided a 30-page report, regarding Clark's background and so forth, including at some point they even had two experts to be ready to testify regarding fetal alcohol syndrome and the consequences. So the more effort that was put in, the more information was brought out, and all this was before the court. Even though the court did not. Take all of this into consideration because his habeas efforts were deemed to be, when they finally got it all together, deemed to be out of time. But then the court says, but if you consider all this, it's a two-edged sword. And he has not shown that the outcome would have been different otherwise. Mm-hmm. And if you had the fetal alcohol syndrome expert, if you had his mother testifying about what he went through as a child, and if you had all of that, the court made the determination, and that's the court's determination, that we can't even consider that. If that had been considered, even at the trial court level, it would not have changed the outcome in terms of the future danger. When you consider that there appears to be evidence that he committed a murder after this murder was committed. So that sort of suggests that it very well might have, he might have been a future danger, at least at that time.
We are here at KPFT 90.1 FM in our Montrose studios. I'm talking with Larry Douglas. I'm talking with Paige Yannick and Mike Gillespie and Jack Lee. How is Mr. Clark being put to death today? Are they using the chemical tripod?
I think Jack's the expert on that. He talks about the cocktail.
They're using a cocktail. I don't remember the actual chemicals off the top of my head, but it's a concoction. It's you know, there's some controversy about it. They want TDCJ gets it. They don't. And there's question as to whether it's medical grade or not, because TDCJ won't allow the compounding the name to be released, because if the name does get released, they're going to get mobbed and there's going to be protests and so on and so forth.
And we've certainly seen that happen here in Houston.
Yeah, and that would happen. And so, to a certain extent, the reason why we can't why we don't have access to the medical compound to find the cocktail is because people are because of the protests, and so that's shutting that down. And
I
so
that there's some death row inmates in Arkansas who are actually suing for the name of who
that's correct.
Is
yeah,
that correct?
That's correct. But I don't know much about that, other than that somebody's suing them in Arkansas.
The time is now 18:42, and I believe we have Linda Hujan on the line now. Of course, as you know, we're going back to Huntsville, where the witnesses walked into the death house. The drugs were administered, and let's talk with Linda Hujan to see what has happened next. Linda.
Hi, Marlo. They just came back across the line at 6:40. So it's over with. That's all we know, because they won't let us inside to see anything.
And the witnesses have left?
Yes, they're already back in the building across the street from the death house.
It's a very sad time, Linda. Thank you so much for your report. Do you have it? Will you be there for us tomorrow as well?
Yes, I will.
All right, we'll be talking with you then. Thank you so
much.
Okay,
thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Linda. Let's go back to Mike Gillespie. Mike?
What I said before was impulsive, but I came here with a point to talk about. Again, I feel taking a man's life, which I'm against, but if society dictates it, it should be in very clear scenarios. This is a case where I'm reading this, and I couldn't quite, I knew it was a horrible murder. But why are we doing an execution? And what we found out is because it was a kidnapping with the murder. Well, you know what? Is it a kidnapping? Legally, I guess, I've been told by my fellow lawyers that when you knock somebody in the head and tie him up and put him in a closet, that's a kidnapping.
Paige, is it a kidnapping?
Yes, it's a kidnapping.
Now, if he had just killed her, when he walked in the door, hit her with a baseball bat, and then put her in a bathtub and all those things, we wouldn't be in capital murder. It would be a murder case. Am I right that kidnapping is why he's being executed?
Well, the closet itself is not why he's being why he was being executed.
If he just killed her.
If he had, had he restrained her and prevented her from moving, that would be a kidnapping. So, I mean, he didn't have to lock her in a closet.
Legally speaking, might be right, but I don't think when the legislator meant this, that's what they meant. I think lay people think kidnapping is you kidnap for money and you kill the victim. I think that's a true kidnapping. I think this is a legal, creative way to kill a man. And I'm back to the point, I think it's a marginal execution, because I think it's a marginal if it's kidnapping. You can justify it, and with these facts, you can be found guilty of it. But a kidnapping is when you take somebody and you're not...
Yeah, Mike, you're wrong.
Go ahead, give us
a well, I might as well quit.
Sit back down, Mike.
Well.
We're not done yet.
If I were not done yet,
you're not leaving me here yet. Jack, tell us why you think Mike is wrong.
You know, we can speculate all we want on legislative intent, but simple fact is when you restrain somebody and you move them, restraining their liberty, that falls under the definition
okay.
of kidnapping.
Then let me give an example, okay? You and me have an argument, and you hit
Which
me.
Time?
And you, okay, the one we're going to have after the show. And you hit me. And I'm unconscious.
Which time?
And you feel guilty. And so you put me in a car and you take me to the hospital. On the way to the hospital, you run over a pedestrian and you kill him. You're going to get executed because you kidnapped me and you kill somebody.
I'm actually taking you to hell.
You kidnapped me.
The intent is...
Of course, the hospital was down the road. Doesn't mean you were going there. Your house could have been down there, too. You kidnapped me.
Mike, that's not...
Here's one end of the bubble gum here. Let's stretch it a little bit.
But isn't that what lawyers do? And by the way, aren't we supposed to be here to come up with a theory of defense? Right or wrong?
No.
Okay.
I'm here to talk about the case. I'm here to talk about what happened. I'm here to talk about why it happened. I'm here to talk about the legal reasons why, you know, I'm here to help people understand why the state of Texas does what it does. I'm not here to make a judgment one way or another to say that what Texas is doing is right or if it's wrong, but I will make the comment that what it does, what Texas is doing is highly inefficient for all of its stated purposes.
Okay, and also KPFT is public radio. And our objective here is to provide a perspective on the executions that our audience are not likely to receive any place else. So we're here to offer perspective, information and perspective to be a public service. And that's what we're attempting to do. The law is the law, and the predicate for the capital here, a murder in addition to, and then there are other statutory grounds that support the implication, the imposing of the death penalty, and one of them being a murder in the course of committing another felony, such as kidnapping. Now, I think it's pretty clear. Yeah, that when you hit somebody with a stun gun and bound their legs and hands and mouth and with duct tape and throw them in a closet, that's a kidnapping. And had he stopped right then, he would have been charged likely with kidnapping. But then he went further in the same episode, and he, according to the witnesses, according to the testimony at trial, committed a murder by then dumping her in the bath, smashing her head hitting her with a board and then drowning her in a bathtub. Okay. That's a separate offense. And because of that additional offense, that is the murder in the course of committing the kidnapping, under our laws, justifies the DA in making the decision to seek the death penalty, and which is what they did.
On that topic, it's a good point. The question of did he or her do this could easily have been answered by the force of those blows of the board. If she couldn't have done it because she wasn't strong enough, then he did it.
And we don't have all the evidence at trial.
But do you think that should have been part of the evidence to show the jury why we gave her 20 and him death? We had some facts to pick to say he did it rather than that she cut a deal?
Don't
you think they need to prove who did it?
We clearly don't have all the evidence at trial, but we know having gone to trials all the time, that there had to have been some evidence to convince the jury. I would think so, he committed the offense.
And we do know that he threatened other people with murder by stating that he had done it before.
Okay, this case might be bad facts, but we're talking the theory for the next case. And let me say something else. Everybody talks about meth, meth, meth. He's been painted as meth is a meth addict. Meth is a horrible drug. But I know a lot of people who use meth who ain't horrible people. I think the problem is all we hear about is the meth people in prison. We don't hear about the meth people who are people in the community who don't get in trouble.
On meth, let me remind everyone that the German army marched on meth in World War II. It was an off the counter drug called Pervitin. I wanted to add one other thing. When earlier Marlo mentioned that the witnesses had had crossed the street and had come out, what that means is that Clark has been executed. He's dead. His body is being moved to the chapel next to the execution chamber, so that his family can touch his body while it's still warm one last time.
Which is something they don't get to do the entire time he's in prison. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
This is a very emotional time for the family, of course, of Troy Clark. We are aware of that. Mike, tomorrow you're going to be leading us through the scheduled execution of Daniel Acre. Is that correct? Do you want to give us a quick preview?
Well, it's funny we're back-to-back, but a lot of these issues are the same issues from my viewpoint. Mm-hmm. This is a scenario in which a woman is thrown out of a car and she's murdered. And they say he choked her and threw her out of the car. He says, I didn't do it. How could I have choked her when I'm driving a car? I'm not getting into that right now. But again, unless we know, and we have had cases of people who are no question serial killers, no question these are bad people. But when you have somebody with a situation like tomorrow, we'll talk about it tomorrow, but both of these cases are not the typical cases that we have had recently. We've had a lot of bad cases this year that it's hard to even stand here and justify what we do.
Absolutely.
But with these, we can, because how many cases have we all had that the fine line between misdemeanor and felonies, second degree, first degree, is so minuscule, it depends on the facts, it depends on the argument of the defense attorneys in court, but more important is the argument of the DA who presented the grand jury that determines where it starts at. And it shouldn't be the arguments to make it a capital, it should be the facts. Everybody should say, that's a capital, period.
All right, well, we're going to be talking about that tomorrow at 6 p.m. right here on 90.1 FM in Houston, and of course, simulcast at kpft.org. Now, as we mentioned at the top of the show, the creator and host of this program is prisoner and civil rights activist Mr. Ray Hill. Ray, thank you for joining us today. We've heard from the Death House that Troy Clark has been executed.
Yes, I know. I've been listening to the show, and I feel like I've gone back into the burglary business, and I'm breaking into a wonderful conversation about the realities of the death penalty as applied to Mr. Clark tonight. I would like to add one thing in reinforcement of Mike. I've been 58 years sober. So I have been in meth houses with crackheads and meth heads, and I know that paranoid circumstance. It doesn't match anything like we would accept as reality, but then neither does life on death row. What has happened since the conviction is a person has gone to death row, they've dried out, and what was the real human being behind the chemical haze of meth addiction and use has emerged, and that human being may have actually had more value than we give him credit for on the occasion of killing him. That's literally what my experience tells me, and I can only speak from my experience because it's the only one I've ever had. I would like to comment that I'm in a hospice right now, and so here I am on the banks of the Styx River waiting for a high sign from the Orman. So I'm in the same situation a lot of you boys down on death row are on. There you sit on the banks of the river waiting your beckoning to the barge. And you're not even going to be given the opportunity to stick a coin under your tongue to pay the oarman. I will be able to do that. The trip, when it comes, will be swift, and there will be no pain afterwards. But let me tell you, while you're alive, do something worthy and useful for what life you have. Each moment is precious. Each moment is unique. I'm sitting here with other people who are waiting the same moment, and I'm able to share stories that they have not heard or ever dreamed of. Do that with one another, brothers. You'll be better for passing this way. And thank you very much, Marlo. And thank you, all the lawyers. Everybody was in character tonight. Everybody did their duty as they saw it to be done. And that voice of God fellow, that Douglas fellow, your analysis is solid gold.
That's all right.
Thank you, Ray.
We got a good crew here. You did a good job, Mr. Hill, and I thank you for putting this show together. There's nothing like it on the airwaves, so thank you very much.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Bye, Ray.
It is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us tomorrow at 6 p.m. for another Execution Watch Special Edition Vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Daniel Acre. We invite you to visit us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all the latest updates, and please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others with and make your secure contribution to this station. A special thanks to our panel, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick, Death House reporter Linda Huhan, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and of course your regular host, Ray Hill. I'm Marlo Blue. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow at 6 p.m. Good night.